Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 110 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me are my usual co-hosts. First, we have David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian. Hi, David.
Hello, everyone.
Also with us is, of course, Rob Mark.
Well, and from the beautiful Jetwine Studios West in Santa Monica, California.
You're always someplace else, aren't you?
I know.
Also with us is Dan Webb.
Well, good evening.
Our guest this episode is Ashley Moore. Ashley is founder and president of the Aviation PR Group. She's an Embry-Riddle graduate. She was associate editor for Professional Pilot Magazine. And she worked for NATA, an aviation association that represents the interests of GA airports, FBOs, and other aviation businesses. Ashley, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you guys tonight. Thank you for having me.
Ashley, the Aviation PR Group helps aviation businesses find niche audiences through marketing, public relations, that sort of thing. Is that a good characterization of what you're all about?
It is. And actually, we are a startup right now. We're getting into the business, and we're using some of my experience and background in education to move forward as a public relations firm in aviation.
Okay, before we get started, you may recall that a few episodes back, we got a voicemail from listener Micah. And actually, we thought his name was Mike, but it turns out his name is Micah. And he mentioned that his 80-year-old mother also listens to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Well, we wanted to find out what that was all about, so we asked. She said yes, and it's our great pleasure to introduce you to her. Harriet, is it true that you really do listen to the Airplane Geeks podcast?
Yes, I do, and I am just honored to be here.
Why do you listen to us? What is it that you like to hear?
Actually, it's a new world to me, although I've been involved with aviation for a very, very long time. You know, I'm going to be 80 next month. But my son's in the stimulus. He's the one, Micah is the one who said, Mom, you got to hear these guys. Mom, you got to hear Betty in the Sky with Suitcase. And
yes.
Mom, you got to hear all these wonderful, wonderful people. He gave me Patrick Smith's book, The Pilot, to read. So he's the stimulus, and I am stimulated.
Well, you've done a couple of, that's good. You've done a couple of very interesting things. I noticed that a few years ago made a trip to the old Rhinebeck Aerodrome in New York, and you actually flew in a biplane?
Yes, I did. And even that was at his, you know, oh, come on, Mom, you'll enjoy it. And I don't know. And when I did go up, I had a blast. I loved every second of it. As a matter of fact, we went up again. So as soon as we came down, got right and up there again. And I had that same feeling with my nephew who owns the Cessna and took me, we were down in Florida, and he said, come on in, huh? I'm going to take you up. And I sat in the back seat, and Micah and my nephew were in front, and I just had the most glorious feeling, the freedom that one feels when one is up there, and the wind and all of the things that, you know, you think about. That's why I told Micah when he stimulated me to read Cannibal Queen, and I said, how could Charlie be in an airplane and go to sleep? You know, it just amazed me. But there is nothing like being in a plane. I just, you know, from commercial flights, they're fine. But you don't really get that same sense as when you're in a biplane or, you know, a Cessna. Even the helicopter up in Vancouver. I had such a blast in that. There I sat right next to the pilot, and I just was overwhelmed with the scenery, the clouds, the whole thing was so wonderful. And the next day, I said to Mike, we have to go back. And I was standing in line, we were waiting for tickets, and this young man came over to me, and he said, is this your first time in the helicopter? I said, well, almost. I said, I was up yesterday. And he said, was your pilot handsome? And I said, oh, yes, he was very handsome. And he started to laugh. He says, I was your pilot. I didn't recognize him. I was so overwhelmed with what was, you know, I was seeing that he was not a factor. But anyway,
you know, Harriet, I you should really think about going to take a discovery flying lesson. I mean, for $99, you can get in there, and instead of sitting in the back seat of that Cessna, they'll put you in the left seat of the Cessna with an instructor, and you can actually experience what it's like to not only to fly, but to actually control the airplane. I mean, you should really think about that.
I don't have that same experience with my nephew. Because he, the second time he took me up, I sat in the front seat next to him, and he turned over the instruments to me, and I was a little bit nervous, having, I was in a plane, but it was fantastic. And the things that he did with that plane, the stalling, being picked up by that wind again, I just loved it. I just absolutely, really had the blast.
Well, see, now you see why people sit in the back of an airliner, all those of us that are pilots sit in the back of an airliner and just hope that someday over the PA we're going to hear someone yell, is there a pilot on board? And then we can all go running out in front.
That's right.
It hasn't happened to me yet, though.
Well, Harriet, it sounds like you're a real airplane geek, and we're honored to have you as a listener. I want to thank you for just spending a few minutes with us on this episode.
I am very honored to be with you.
I think we should send Harriet an Airplane Geeks t-shirt.
Yes, that's a great idea. So, Harriet, we won't ask you for your size on the air, but we'll find out, and we'll send you a t-shirt.
I appreciate that so very much. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks again, Harriet.
My pleasure.
Bye, Harriet.
Hey, come back.
Bye-bye. Be well.
Bye.
Our 80-year-old listener. I think that's really great.
That's amazing. She's fantastic. And she's done so much. I got a list from Micah of all the things that she's, or many of the things she's done. And she's traveled all over the world and doesn't appear to be, slowing down at the least, which I think is just fantastic.
Well, Carlene, I know you're out there and I know you're piloting an Airbus somewhere, but I have a new crush on a guest.
Yes. Yes. All right, well, why don't we get started with the news? Is everyone ready?
Yes.
Our first story comes from the Associated Press. This is JetBlue Memo Questions Flight Attendant's Motive. Well, I think everybody has heard of the story about flight attendant Stephen Slater by now. This is a flight attendant who says that he kind of had a little altercation maybe with one of the passengers. Didn't go as smoothly as one would like. He says that in the process of stowing some luggage in the overhead bin, that he ended up with a gash in his head. And in the end, he got on the PA system, announced that he'd basically had enough, grabbed a couple of beers, activated the emergency slide, and disappeared from the aircraft. It's, there's a lot of debate going on as to whether or not this was an appropriate or professional thing for a flight attendant to do. But one of the interesting aspects of this is kind of how the online media played into this. The initial reaction that we saw, I think, was a lot of support from not just flight attendants and people in the aviation industry, but others who are kind of fed up with some of the customers that they have to work with from time to time. And it's an interesting issue. I mean, Ashley, do you think that JetBlue is treating this in an appropriate fashion?
Each company, aviation or not, has their own communication plan and strategy. And what's been interesting about JetBlue is that they have a history of being pretty open with their customers and with the public, through their blog, Blue Tails, and then, of course, through their Twitter account. They've been pretty quiet on the issue with only small blog posts the Wednesday after the incident, and then I think minimal tweets about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, what they've been doing is kind of different from the strategy they've been taking. But you have to understand that there's a lot of legal stuff going on behind the scenes.
Right. I mean, he's been charged with a crime.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, they don't want to make light of this situation and then have it used against them later by Slater's attorneys or worse by the FAA. So I think it might be a good strategy for them right now. And after the legal aspect has moved through, they might be a little more talkative on this aspect.
Can I ask a question on this, though? I mean, the guy's in New York at JFK, and he says a passenger is rude, and then the flight attendant's rude back to him and all the passengers. What's the story? I mean, it's New York, right?
Oh.
I mean, come on.
And yet another segment of our listeners is now mad at Rob.
Yeah.
My only residual questions about this is, what was the beer, and when does he start doing his commercials?
Well, I understand, actually, he's already started doing one for some kind of a New York City fitness center or something like that, that's apparently kind of known for building commercials around current events. And I think in this one, you know, the point they make is that, you know, you need to be trim and fit if you're going to go down the slide.
Yeah, this has gotten a lot of social media pickup. I mean, all over Twitter and then on Facebook. I just checked it on Facebook. He has his own page, right? Oh, he's probably got a couple pages, but on one of his pages, he's got over 209,000 people liking this public figure page. And he's got 3,149 people that like it, that White Castle should rename it, you know, their little slider burgers. Mm-hmm. They should rename them Slaters. But, okay. You know, everyone's having a good time with it. The public's having a good time with it. But in the end, I think it's the right choice for JetBlue to be kind of quiet on until they find out a little more.
So you guys, let's take a little poll here. How many of you think that this guy is some sort of a cult hero? I mean, I could see where it's an interesting, rather unique story for a while, but I guess I don't understand that this cult status that this guy has reached because he said something to a bunch of clients on an airplane, blew the emergency chute, and slid down. But maybe it's the pilot in me, and I'm being too narrow-minded on this.
It reminds me of that movie, I think it was called Network. You know, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. You know, the newscaster just sort of blew it off. I think that there are, you know, a lot of people who are frustrated. I mean, certainly we're in some economic times that causes a lot of anxiety and frustration for people. And, you know, patience is thin in general, I think. And, you know, when someone, you know, comes out and basically, you know, says that they're, you know, they're not going to take it anymore, they deserve better, it sort of resonates with people. But at the same time,
I always thought that was the passengers that usually were the ones that were upset. It's the first time I've heard of the employees really losing their minds.
Yeah, but Rob, look at it this way. The social media circles that we run in, we're going to get that perspective. If it was this happened 6 years ago, we would have gotten it just from whatever we saw in cable television. In this case, we're getting it from an inside perspective. We're talking to people like the Crew Lounge guy, the flight attendants, the Crew Lounge podcast, and all of the ones that are in our circle that are in that business and can look at it from his perspective, not just the passenger's perspective.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it's a little early to decide on the folk hero status. I mean, on one hand, the story, it's definitely pretty damn funny, I'm not gonna lie. But on the other hand, it's cost a lot of money to replace that emergency slide. And had someone been on the ground and not paying attention, cause I think if you're working on the ramp, you're really not expecting for the slide been at the wrong place at the wrong time. And I think JetBlue pointed this out in an internal memo.
Right.
Someone could have gotten seriously hurt here.
Or killed even. These things deploy very fast, like 6 seconds. I asked on Twitter, you know, if anyone knew how much it costs to repack or replace, you know, one of these slides. And in fact, Gavin from our host, our guest from last week said that his understanding was it's around $25,000 is what it takes. Plus deploying that slide, that takes that aircraft right out of service.
Right. So, yeah. So I'm not sure exactly how long it takes to replace, but at least say that plane's out of service for the rest of the day. And I mean, it's definitely funny, but I think definitely wasn't professional. No,
I know you're right. It wasn't professional. But does this guy really deserve to go to jail? I mean, come on. You know, I grant you, there's the aspect of this where someone could have been hurt. You're right; they could have been, but they weren't, and it cost the airplane or cost the airline some money to repack it. You're right; they took the airplane out of service, cost him some more. The guy lost his job, but I mean, criminal.
Well, he hasn't officially been fired yet. Actually,
he hasn't. Oh, I thought he had. I'm surprised at that.
Yeah, him too.
Not everything's been investigated. This point, so
yeah, that's true. And
hey, Rob and Max and Dan, I got a question for you. Since Rob is very much this should go to jail, what's worse, the kids up in the control tower or deploying the slide on the apron?
Oh, deploying the slide.
Yeah, I think deploying the slide.
Which is worse? Well, I'm not sure what you mean in terms of which is worse. In the tower situation, I didn't see the point in that one either as being so serious because there was somebody right there that was going to grab the mic from the kid in case he said something bad. And here, I agree with you guys that I think certainly somebody could have been hurt, but this guy lost his mind. He just lost his mind. He had it and he quit. I mean, he quit in kind of an interesting way, and maybe they don't know he quit yet, but I guess I'm still not quite sure what the whole thing's about it to some degree.
All right. Well, I think at very least this is Stephen Slater's 15 minutes of fame.
15 minutes?
Yeah.
15 days.
Yeah. Well, we'll see if it has any legs to it. Okay. But let's go on to our next story. This is...
thank you. I'm sick of this story already.
I know.
I feel how David feels about the tanker. I know what that feels like.
Yes. Now you can identify with that. Bloomberg reports Southwest may add bigger 737 jet for business routes. Now, Southwest, who of course only flies the 737, is looking at the possibility of moving to the 737-800, which is a step up to, I think, 175 seats. That compares to the 137 in the Dash 700, which they have quite a few of. And according to this article, the idea is to increase capacity but hold the fleet size steady. So if that's true, that would imply that these would be replacement aircraft for others that they already have. The managing director of Piper Jaffray and Company said that the 737-800's fuel consumption per seat is 10% or more lower than the 737-700 on most missions, which would be a significant savings. Dan, was this something that you were expecting to see?
I think it's something that a lot of people have thought about for a while. It's a rumor / discussion that's been occurring on the magical interwebs for years. So I think it's an interesting move. Obviously, it's not as dramatic as say a JetBlue saying we're going to add the E190 to our fleet because you're staying within the 737 family. It's a sister to the, so you have a lot of commonality there. Now that Southwest hasn't, changed gauge on the 737 before. I mean, the 737-300 is bigger than the 200, but there are some things that happen now with the 800 being a bit longer. So, for example, Southwest hasn't said how they're going to configure this thing yet, but it's probably most likely going to be under 150 seats unless they do something like JetBlue. So, FAA Part 121, Section 391, I believe, would require a fourth flight attendant.
Oh.
That creates some issues because right now, so, and it maybe it's changed, but when I sat, when me and Johnny Jett and Crankire sat down with Gary Kelly about a year ago now, we talked about this, and he said that right now Southwest, their systems, hardwired, I think he said we're hardwired three flight attendants. So, adds a little bit of complexity in terms of crew scheduling, so something has to happen there, but also the Transport Workers Union said on Friday, and that's the union that represents Southwest flight attendants, that this requires a change to their agreement with Southwest. So in 3.5 months, Southwest and the TWU need to renegotiate and ratify a new contract. It's just because Southwest's December 1 Southwest drop-dead date for this because they would like to get the 800s by early 2012. So it definitely creates some issues. Another issue is just because, fuselage is a little bit longer than the 7th work. Airport-wise, are there any does it fit at every gate the 700 fits at?
Mm-hmm.
What happens on the ramp? So do you need other more employees on the ground to handle this? Southwest, obviously, very well, quick, the magical 15, 20-minute turn, have a few more rows of seats. That adds the turn time. I mean, they're saying high frequent, very high traffic routes, but also airports that are constricted in some way. So LaGuardia would scream out to me, Southwest only has 8 slots. They could possibly get more slots, but it's going to be expensive. They're not going to conceivably not get a whole lot of LaGuardia slots in the next couple of years. So a larger aircraft work in that environment. Southwest has expressed interest in serving National in D.C., which is also slot controlled. They were trying to take advantage of the slot deal, but that's stuck in the courts right now. But I really think this is guided by Wright Amendment restrictions being lifted from Love Field in 2014. So a little bit of history is thanks to the Wright Amendment, Southwest is restricted. I forget the exact verbiage. Airplanes over 50 seats cannot fly out of Love Field and except to states bordering Texas, and I think Missouri was added as an exemption. But Southwest reached a compromise. That restriction will be listed. They can fly anywhere in the country nonstop out of Love Field in 2014. But the air is going to be capped at 20 gates. So that's another restriction. And if what's interesting is Southwest changed around their 737 order book when they announced the second quarter earnings, and which is interesting because Southwest said that these would not be new orders. These would be conversions of existing 737-700 orders. Mm-hmm. And there are two really big changes in the number of orders. In 2012, when the 700s would start coming in, Southwest firm orders have increased from 13 aircraft to 23 aircraft. And then in 2014, which is when the Love restrictions are lifted, and when I think the 800s could work, the number of firm orders has gone from 13 to 21 aircraft. And then Southwest jiggled around their options and purchase rights to give themselves an additional 6 options for 2014,
mm-hmm.
since for 2012 now. So I think it's a very interesting move. It could definitely work very well on some, and just because it's the 800 is a longer than the 700, could potentially bring a reduction in use for Southwest, which would be nice. It'd just be interesting to see Southwest go bigger, with Southwest being so committed to 137 seats. I mean, the only thing that differ are the 737-500s, which seats 122, and that's a very small fleet. I believe less than 30 aircraft.
The next item comes from Helium. Helium notes that Delta has come up with something rather interesting. The title of this is Delta Airline Unveils Option for Customers to Book Flights on Facebook. And so now you can go to the Delta Facebook page, and you can book your flights right there. You don't have to go to Delta's website. You don't have to go to other travel planning websites. You can go right to what they call the ticket window and purchase your tickets there. Is this a stroke of brilliance, or is this just sort of the next evolutionary step?
I was reading about this today, and this is something I'm actually very excited about. I mean, this is something where the airlines have seen that they need to be innovative and do some cost savings activities.
Right.
And instead of, paying $5 to some of these flight booking websites like Travelocity and Orbitz, I mean, what a great way to get people to just book through Facebook instead for free.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think it's an interesting cost saving tactics. And in that article, they were talking about it's reaching their target audience, which is young and tech savvy, travel friendly people, and that Facebook is used by more people on Delta flights on their Wi-Fi than any other website. So, I mean, it definitely seems like they're hitting their target audience with this.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I mean, probably this isn't a method that everyone's going to use but yes, certainly for a certain segment of Delta's customers. I think they'll probably just jump right into it.
I mean, I tried this thing on Facebook.
Yeah, did it work?
And I mean, like, it's kind of cool, but is my reaction. It's like
a work in progress.
I mean, like, right. Well, like here's my analogy, and it's a dumb analogy, but bear with me. like back in the day, I had this really cool appliance that would toast your bread, cook an egg, and cook meat at the same time to make like a breakfast sandwich. And it was cool and all, but I'm like, is this really more convenient than doing everything myself? Like, do I really need this crap? And I didn't. So I threw it out. I mean, like the thing's like only 460 pixels wide. Now that I measured it. So it's like kind of cramped. And I kind of like going on Delta.com seat map when I book. And
so does it have less features than what you'd experience on Delta's website?
Yeah, it appears like it has a few less features. I'd rather just maybe sell on Facebook there. I could set like, you know, origin, destination, my dates, and, you know, what cabin I want to be in. And I'd almost prefer just if it just boot me over to Delta.com, to be completely honest.
Know, that's funny. See, that's what I was going to ask, because when I first read this, I thought that's what they were intending to do, was to use Facebook as a special gateway for those people. As Ashley said, that's a target. It's a different target audience. But why would you try to reinvent the wheel when you have everything you need at the Delta site? And I could see allowing people to get to the Delta site through there, but to give them an abbreviated version, I don't know. I guess I'm a little surprised at that.
I think it has a certain like why not factor, you know, like why not try this and see if it works. Like if they just get 1% of people that go to Travelocity and Orbitz and some of these travel booking websites to book through their Facebook, I mean, think of the money they're going to save.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like $5 for each booking. I don't know the cost savings, like how much it costs to actually set this up on Facebook and, you know, all the technology involved with it. But why not, you know, even if it has a small impact?
No, I don't disagree. I'd just rather have something that boots me at Delta.com, because I'm finding the thing just not as usable.
I mean, maybe they're hoping that someone will just be on Facebook scrolling through, looking at their friends, checking things out. I mean, how many hours do we all spend a day on Facebook? I mean, tons of time, you know? And, you know, they come across this and they go, oh, maybe I should take a flight on Delta. And then, you know, they just type in Delta to their Google and go to their website. Maybe they're just hoping it's another way to contact people, reach them. I mean,
I don't disagree with you, Ashley, but I'll tell you, I still think I agree with Dan on that. I think if you shortchange, and that's what it sounds like to me from what I saw of it, it's a kind of a Delta light. And I don't know why you wouldn't give the people that are coming in through Facebook sort of the opportunity to have the full Delta experience. I mean, maybe it's just me, but I mean, I like looking at that chart and being able to see where I'm going to fit. And if that doesn't allow you to do that, I mean, I'm not certain what they're gaining. I mean, maybe a body for a flight, but will those people come back?
Well, maybe it's a case of or a matter of Delta sort of dipping their toe in the water and seeing what they find. You know, maybe this is the first version and see if it starts to generate some interest. And if it does, then they can always look to, you know, sort of expand the capability or try other things. And probably other airlines will also try maybe similar, maybe different approaches to you know, linking up with new media like Facebook and some other things.
Yeah, I mean, it has good stuff, and I like how you can like share your itineraries on your Facebook wall, and that way other people can, you know, go on. That stuff's all cool, but
yeah,
okay.
All right. Well, we have another article about new media. This comes from the Globe and Mail. This is 5 social media lessons for Air Canada. And this centers around a story where a passenger, a 10-year-old boy actually, named Tanner Bond, he suffers from a terminal illness. He was traveling to New York City to live out one of the wishes he had, one of his final wishes, and his motorized wheelchair was damaged in the flight. There wasn't much from Air Canada, apparently, you know, immediately following that. And so his aunt tweeted a message saying that Air Canada killed Tanner's wheelchair. We're now stuck at LaGuardia. And that sort of started a chain of events where, you know, thousands of other messages, tweets and other comments started, you know, flying around concerning this issue. So it actually turns out that Air Canada really was doing something as this was happening. And in fact, in the end, I think replaced his his wheelchair and offered them a trip to Disneyland, I guess. But they just weren't very communicative about it during the process. So in this article, which is actually written by Amber MacArthur, who is a notable new media person, appears in a lot of different podcasts, audio and video, has five tips for Air Canada, but really could be applied in any case. Ashley, are there any of these particularly resonate with you?
You know, Max, I think all of the points that was mentioned in this article are all great, valid points. And I mean, you have to be interacting, whether it's positive or negative press, with your, you know, with your audience, with your Twitter friends, and I mean, you have to communicate, like, give updates and keep people in the loop on what's going on, because social media moves fast, whether you're there or not, you know. And I think that, I mean, this is kind of an unfortunate, kind of heartbreaking story, and those kind of stories are going to move even faster. And so, I mean, if you're not participating in the conversation, it's going to go on without you. And this is a perfect example of that for Air Canada. You know, some people have to learn the lesson the hard way. And I was on Twitter today, you know, looking through to see what kind of presence Air Canada did have. And they do have an account. It's called AC_WebSaver. Hmm. They have some type of a presence there. But, I mean, it's not a verified account. And so, I mean, this is a suggestion I would give to anyone that's on Twitter. If you're a company, if you're, you know, you need to have a verified account so people know that you're the real deal and that you're the one that they should be going to for this kind of stuff. So,
yeah, but when you get right down to this, is still United Breaks Guitars all over again.
Yeah,
it really is.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it just is.
No, I don't think it is.
No,
I don't think it is.
How's this different?
Sure, Dan? It is. Because they didn't, they didn't tell anybody what they were doing.
Here's what happened. Because Air Canada just was total, granted, they dropped the ball from a communication perspective. But what happened with United is United was doing nothing. Dave Carroll posts video, United fixes problem. Here, Air Canada's fixing problem, just no one knows.
Yeah, but see, I think in the social media world, maybe it's me, but I think it doesn't make any difference to the people that are out there because they're running with it already. And I think Air Canada caused themselves more harm with this than they needed. I mean, they could have just long ago have done exactly what Ashley mentioned, which was had a verified Twitter account, and they could have been up there in 10 minutes when this happened, if they'd had their act together. And I don't think they did. So.
Exactly.
Well, if you're complaining to an airline, use the proper Twitter handle. I mean,
and what would that
be? Air Canada. But I feel like if I was the person complaining here, I would slap Air Canada. Make sure, you know, and it was actually staffed. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, they used.
I don't disagree with that. I mean, I think they should have had that in place long before now. I mean, look at United's though. Did you ever try to complain about anything at United Airlines on Twitter? They don't respond to anything. At least I've never seen them respond.
I've never not gotten a response from United.
On Twitter?
I'll be honest. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, then they must recognize you as a verifiable threat.
Yeah.
Well, so United's done very well over the past couple months. I was actually impressed because I was when I flew them a couple weeks ago, they were actually advertising Twitter over the IFE, and I was very impressed by that.
Okay.
I mean, they can definitely do a better job, but I think the other thing for airline customer is that Twitter might not always be the best form.
Well, but best form. Let's be serious. If you went to United, got rid of all their customer contact information off their website, what was that, a year or two ago? So I mean, if you were upset about something on a United flight, what would you do, or what would you tell people to do? I mean, and this is us, and we have some understanding of how some of this communication works, but look at the poor guy that just happened to get on the flight in San Francisco to Atlanta, and he has a bad trip, and he doesn't even have a clue what to do.
Yeah, I think that the airlines need, as is true for any business, really, you need to be watching wherever it is that your customers speak out, whether it's a good venue for that or not, it doesn't matter. If it's possible that they'd be out there on Twitter, you need to be, in fact, that's the first tip is, you know, listen well and often. you need to be out there monitoring what people say, because as Ashley said, these things can move incredibly fast. The second tip, Amber's second tip, is reach out to the individual. And I think that's extremely important. And again, regardless of whatever medium the individual, the customer initiates the conversation, you got to go to that person. But then also the third tip is interesting, which is reach out to everyone, which means that while an individual may have an issue and you may want to deal with that individual to resolve that issue, the airline's got to recognize that everyone else is watching. And so it's the collective that you have to manage. Otherwise, you risk losing control.
Right. And Max, from a PR perspective, I mean, I think that one is probably key, because, I mean, in reaching out to everyone, you're talking back, you're having a conversation with people. And so you want to kind of head these things off, but before they turn into a huge online conversation, and reporters and bloggers and podcasters catch wind of it. Because once they catch wind of it, it's a story, and you can't control that press anymore.
It's like a hurricane. it's got a life of its own.
Exactly, because the media is heavily on Twitter, and if you're not communicating with them and you're not communicating with your your audience, they're going to see that, and it's going to be reported. So it's just something that companies have to be aware of.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, let's shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit of military aviation. We see from...
Ooh, are we going to talk about tankers?
No, we're not going to talk about tankers. Oh. I think there was no new... that's not true. There was some new tanker news. Actually, Richard Abulafia did a great interview concerning some of the comments around that the tanker decision may get delayed. But I'll put a link to that in the show notes. He doesn't think it will. He thinks they're going to stick to November.
And then we had that... on Monday or Tuesday when we had that plane crash and there was with the East America CEO on board.
Oh, we're going to come to that.
Okay.
But before we do, this is from, if I can get this right, RIA Novosti, which I think is a Russian news agency. Russia and NORAD complete joint air defense drills. So the Russian Air Force and NORAD, which is the North American Aerospace Defense Command, conducted some anti-terrorism drills, some joint drills. They called this Vigilant Eagle. And this included both U.S. Air Force personnel and also Canadian personnel. And what they did is they conducted a scenario that required both the Russian Air Force and NORAD to launch or to divert fighter aircraft to investigate and intercept a U.S.-flagged Gulfstream IV, supposedly on an international flight that had been taken over by terrorists. Is this an unusual thing, or do we do this all the time?
There's this thing in the White House called the red phone. Yeah. It's used to contact the Kremlin to the White House in case of an emergency. It was during the Cold War. It was to prove open communication between the two should an emergency happen.
Right.
This scenario, besides Mexico and Canada, Russia is our nearest neighbor. Most people don't realize that, but we are only like 4 miles away from Canada, from Russia in the Bering Sea. What this was a way of developing a communication system should a terrorist, so that if our aircraft are escorting a hijacked aircraft, we do not want the Russians to scramble up their Sukhois to shoot down our F-22s starting a war. They did the process twice, Thursday and yesterday. The first process was the Russians escorted the Gulfstream eastward and handed it off to the Alaskan Air Force F-22 Raptors. So you had Sukhoi Su-35s handing off the Raptors. We reversed the process yesterday and transferred the aircraft from the United States airspace to Russian airspace. This is not what I would call a large-scale, open, the next war we're going to be fighting hand-in-hand with the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a way of developing a communication system should a third party be involved, that we can work together so that we're not escalating things where we'll be fighting each other due to a high tension environment.
Right.
And I think something that's interesting about this philosophically is that although we have not certainly had a smooth relationship with the Russians since the Cold War ended 20 years ago, this terrorism issue is certainly something that that both countries can come together on. Because let's say the Russians had terrible, terrible terrorist incidents. And so I think this particular one probably really strikes home with them. And they, I actually am pretty impressed that they figured out a way to get NORAD and the Russian Air Force working together. I mean, that's just unbelievable to me.
Yeah, it does seem pretty cool. I wonder what the, not the motivation, but I wonder where the impetus for this came. I wonder, was this something that we initiated or the Russians?
Good question. Yeah, I don't know.
Just sort of the process by which you pull this off.
There is international law on aircraft interception. All of us have seen pictures of F-15s tagging Russian bears, the Russians have got fox bats tracking. So there are... This is just an accentuation of the rules that had already been set up. Like when a Russian bear is flying in international airspace, like the what they call the UK-Iceland gap, the bears used to fly from Russia and fly all the way down to Cuba on the Atlantic Ocean. They would be intercepted by either British aircraft, Tornadoes, or F-15s from Sosnovyj Air Force Base. But there are certain rules. One is you never pointed the gun at the aircraft coming up to, quote, intercept you. The guns were always stowed. So the only flashes that were going off were the cameras in both airplanes. So there were already procedures set up for this kind of environment. This is just one of those, let's reinforce what we already know and see if we can make it a bit smoother.
Okay. Yeah, presumably we'll see, I guess, other kind of joint exercises like this in the future.
It's a start. We'll see where it goes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Dan mentioned the crash in Alaska. This, of course, was the single-engine Otter that crashed that killed former U.S. Senator Ted Stevens, the pilot, some others. Also on this flight was the EADS CEO, who did survive the crash. There's a lot of discussion going on in the press I see about air safety in Alaska, and we've talked about bush pilots in the past. I don't know, Rob, do you think this is this going to precipitate some kind of requirement, a change in requirements or regulations concerning general aviation aircraft?
I'm sure it will, although honestly, if that was not Senator Stevens and Sean O'Keefe on that airplane, if that had been you on that airplane, there would be no call for any changes to the regulations. And that's probably the thing that really stinks about that. You know, flying in Alaska is different. I mean, but small airplanes are a way of life, is how Alaska survives. I mean, there are places in Alaska that are only accessible through airplanes, and it forces them into situations that are different than we have down here in the lower 48. However, you know, accidents happen. It's not usually just one issue. I'm sure they're going to look back at this. I mean, this was not their normal pilot. This was a fill-in guy. I don't mean to say that he was not experienced. He may have been or may not have been. I don't know. But point is, you had a situation where it was a new pilot, and who knows what the weather was like. We don't know how the weather may have changed. However, if you saw the pictures of the airplane sitting on the side of the hill, it certainly says something about the strength of the airplane, but you also get an idea that he had opportunity at the last moment to pull up, because he did not impact that ground at a 90-degree angle. That seems to be pretty clear, because there's an awful lot of that airplane that's still intact.
Right. Okay, well, it'll be interesting. You know, these investigations take time, obviously, as we've seen in the past. It takes a while before all the facts are determined and revealed, so we'll be following that, I think. Our last story, this comes from the Financial Times. It's kind of an interesting story. It's called, "Will Pilotless Aircraft Be Safer in Flight?" I think it's interesting because it raises some kind of intriguing issues. One is that, you know, we've seen a progression here, you know, starting with autopilots maybe and how they've increased in sophistication over the years. We see from the military the increased use of unmanned aerial vehicles. We've also seen, you know, unmanned transportation devices in other areas, including, for example, railways. There's some passenger trains that are unmanned. And we're even starting to see some work done with automobiles that don't require drivers. So it's interesting to sort of speculate or to extrapolate that and say, you know, gee, could this become the case for airlines? Now, when we bring this up in the past, obviously the folks who come from a piloting background always say, you know, no way, and that includes our very own Rob. But an interesting point that this article makes is, you know, when you look at causes for crashes, most of the time it's pilot error. So, you know, Rob, if someone says, well, if most of the time it's caused by pilot error, wouldn't it be a good thing if we could eliminate the source of that error and just go with pilotless aircraft? Does that make any sense at all?
Only that, if it was only that simple. I mean, we wouldn't have any problems with flight attendants either if we got rid of them.
That's right. No unauthorized escape slides.
Wouldn't have anybody yanking the emergency chute. You wouldn't have anybody grabbing beers. I don't know. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that we've seen changes to the industry in terms of employees and how people are employed. And I don't remember ever saying that I didn't think we'd ever have a situation where there'd be no pilots. I just said I didn't think I'd like it.
Mm.
But I honestly, I don't doubt that there's going to come a time when there will be aircraft flying around without pilots and with people in the back. I think it's not something that's going to happen overnight. But I mean, we got rid of there used to be four pilot airplanes. You know, a navigator, a radio operator, and two pilots. And then it went to a flight engineer and two pilots. And then it went to two pilots alone. And the fact that it's going to go to one someday, I absolutely believe that. But it's just going to be gradual. It's just going to take a cultural change because people are going to have a little trouble being up there in this aluminum box with nobody up front driving. I just think it's a little... Well, how would you guys, would you like to do that? I feel a little creepy about that myself.
Yeah, not really. I don't think I'd feel entirely comfortable with that.
If their computers are Windows-based, there's no way.
No.
I mean, maybe if it was a Mac-based system, I'd feel a little more confident.
David, you were going to say?
What difference does it make if the pilot's in the cockpit or the pilot is in a box on the ground?
Because the pilot in the airplane has a perspective of something going on that somebody on the ground does not. I mean, if there is a mechanical issue on an airplane, it could be a fire, it could be who knows what. It's watching a TV picture of that and reacting is not quite the same. And honestly, I'll tell you something else I just thought of really is that although pilots are taught for years not to panic, I think that the adrenaline that flows through our bodies when something significant happens helps us resolve the problem. And I wonder whether someone that is sitting on a ground 5,000 miles away from the actual airplane behind a flight sim is going to have that same energy.
Yeah,
to
that's a really interesting thought. Huh.
I don't know if we're going to see this in our lifetime, guys. I mean, yeah. Like so
you
much
might in your lifetime, but I don't think I will.
No, me either. I mean, if you think about this whole human in the loop thing, even with air traffic control, I don't know if we're going to see non-human in the loop in our lifetime for air traffic control either. I mean, it's a huge safety measure.
Yeah.
And it's definitely one that the FAA bases a lot of their safety measures around, you know, pilot in command, pilot observation. I mean, I don't see this happening for a long time.
Well, it certainly, I mean,
we'd have to redo unions. Like all kinds of FMS would have to be redone. And
we're just not ready yet.
Wait, yeah. Let's ask our airline expert. Dan, would you have any problem flying in the back of a United airplane if there was nobody up front?
That's a really good question.
It just creeps me out myself, but I think listeners ought to tell us too. We ought to get some email on this. How do you feel about flying in the back of an airplane with nobody up front driving?
Yeah, it creeps me out a little, but I feel like after the first time, maybe... I don't know. I mean, to argue the opposite of what you said, granted, I'm not a pilot, and never, you know, would never want to hold myself responsible for the livelihoods of over 100 people on a plane. But when I'm under an adrenaline rush, my thinking is very poor.
Huh.
So I guess having additional people on the ground actually be a benefit.
And we do want to hear what listeners have to say, except for Steve and Grant. We know what they have to say already.
Yeah.
Or, since they're going to be the new CEOs of Tiger Airways anyhow, I heard. Yeah. So maybe that's just...
And I just posted the question to our Facebook page.
Oh, good. So.
Good, good. Okay.
Last episode, we offered up a few free coupon codes to the new World Airport Data app for the iPhone. And we got some responses back. David, do you have the results for us?
Drum roll, please.
That was the shortest drum roll I've ever heard.
Okay. Well, we've got three listeners that will be getting the World app codes, and I'll announce why they were chosen by their quotes. First one is Kevin Heisterman. He's a longtime listener, and he was the one who sent us the Russian bikini airline clip.
Ah, yes.
The next one is Ben Stevens, and his reason was, I have a round-the-world trip coming up in October. I'd love to give the app a try.
Great.
And lastly, we have Stuart Stevenson. I love the show, and I really enjoyed seeing Rob again at OSH10. I suppose it was good seeing Dan, too. It's just hard to admit that one.
Oh, that was an easy winner, huh?
So congratulations, Kevin, Ben, and Stuart. Send us an email. We have your email, and we'll send you out the codes. And remember, part of this deal was you need to come back and tell us and give us a review of the app after you use it.
That's great. Okay, thanks, David. Our guest this episode is Ashley Moore, president of the Aviation PR Group. Ashley, again, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I've really enjoyed speaking with you guys about some of the news items. So thank you.
What caused you to create the Aviation PR Group? What was your motivation for that?
Well, you know, Aviation PR Group is it's a pretty new startup, and we're an aviation boutique communication and PR firm based in the DC area. And we're using my experience in aviation and in public relations to kind of build a client base and you know, get our name out there right now. Let's see, I was first inspired to do public relations while I was at Embry-Riddle. I started out as an engineer at Embry-Riddle Daytona Beach and ended up as a communication major. So, yes, they do have communication degrees at Embry-Riddle.
Good.
You know, my goal there was to do some type of public relations in aviation, and I didn't know where that would take me or even if there was a market for that. And so I took my first job at Professional Pilot Magazine as an associate editor, and I came in contact with a couple of media professionals in aviation, like Bill Coleman, and you know, it taught me that there is a market for PR, and it's pretty niche-y. And so, I mean, just over the years, working in different fields, like high tech PR, I realized that aviation is a very important niche. And, you know, it's one that has a reputation of being kind of sluggish to pick up new media and social media. Mm. But I'm not sure why that is, because there's a lot of high tech aspects to aviation. And so I just thought I would, you know, start this PR firm that used some of my high tech experience. I had clients like Microsoft Public Sector and Artel, their satellite company, ICSA Labs, NetWitness, and so it was like very, very high tech. And so I got to know some of the reporters and built some relationships there and realized that there is a correlation with aviation, you know, with e-flight bags and then just all the stuff in the cockpit that's so technical. And so, you know, next thing I know, I want to start an aviation PR firm. And so we've just kind of hit the ground running and got it started.
Are there some companies that you see that do PR particularly well and others that you see are at the other end of that spectrum?
You know, in aviation, just like all, I mean, just like all industries, you know, obviously the bigger businesses, they're pretty well versed in it. So, you know, most of the airlines do public relations pretty well. And a lot of the airports do public relations pretty well, some of the bigger airports. And I think some of the smaller airports that kind of strike me that do pretty good PR, and they've been basing a lot of their strategy around social media, is airports like Akron Canton Airport, and Richmond Airport, Harrisburg International Airport. Those are some of the airports that I follow on Twitter. And I mean, I think they do really great stuff social media wise. You know, they're really engaging and they kind of keep me involved in what's going on in their airports. And I really like them as far as social media and PR wise.
Well, do you view social media aspects of public relations as just a small piece of the total public relations activities of an airport or an airline, or is it the centerpiece? I mean, what's the role? How does it fit in the total public relations, you know, mix?
You know, when I was working for Merit Group, they're the high-tech PR firm based in Reston. One of the things that I learned from them is that you have to have a blended approach. And I mean, social media is very new. Well, I guess not too new, since Facebook's been around for almost like 6 years now, and Twitter's coming up on 3 years. So you just have to have a blended approach. You know, you have to use traditional public relations in your business, whether you're small or large, you know, the traditional stuff, the press releases, the building relationships, you know, going out to conferences, meeting the writers, just the traditional PR stuff. And then you also have to use the new media, the Twitter, the Facebook, the LinkedIn, you know, Wikipedia. And if it fits your business model, blogs, you know, I just think that you have to have a blended approach. And that's one of the things that Aviation PR Group is trying to bring, you know, small, large companies, is that blended approach.
Is your idea that, you know, you would provide those kinds of services to your clients, or teach them how to become self-sufficient?
Either or. I think to be effective in social media, you have to have an understanding from a client's perspective why it's important. And so definitely, you know, trying to teach people the importance of, you know, social media and just public relations in general. I think it's hard for a lot of companies to latch on to public relations, you know, when they have small budgets, and, you know, it's tough to measure. I'm sure as Rob Mark knows, you know, PR and marketing, it's hard to measure. And that's one of the things that the industry is trying to do, is become more measurable. But I think, you know, teaching them the appreciation for public relations, what it has to offer people, would be probably the first line of what I would bring to a company. And then, you know, teaching them to use the tools, because I mean, as a PR person, or you don't want to just be tweeting for people, you don't want to just be ghostwriting blogs, you want to be helping them devise their strategy and tweak their communications plan, and you know, make sure that it all works together. And so, you know, sometimes it's, I mean, JetBlue has 7 people doing Twitter, and I know Southwest has a whole band of people. I mean, all these big companies have tons of people doing social media. So it's, I mean, it's definitely enough to do in-house and externally combined.
You know what I think is interesting, though, too, to follow up on that, is that these big companies that do have it, some of the airlines, and how many large companies in our industry are still doing nothing because they don't understand. And they, you know, having run into this myself, sometimes people in charge of a business say, well, if I don't get it myself, that it can't be that important. And unfortunately,
right.
It is. And so there's the control issue, which all of us sometimes face in this industry. I mean, people in the aviation industry like to control things, and they don't like what they can't control.
Right. And they don't like risk.
No, that's true. They are a little conservative.
Right. Fairly risk adverse. So how do you convince somebody, or not really convince them, but how do you help someone see the, you know, the upside of becoming engaged in new media, and the downside of not being engaged in it. How do you, you know, short of a disaster or a problem, let's say, like we saw with, you know, Air Canada earlier in the show, you know, short of that kind of a wake-up call, how do you tell people? How do you show people?
Case studies, you know, try and show them some lessons learned in aviation and outside of aviation.
Wait, go slower. Ashley, go slower. I'm trying to write this down.
I'm sure you've been preaching this for like for years now, Rob, but oh, I mean, you just have
No, I guess that would be more like decades.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. I love these
young
guys.
Young at heart.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think what you have to show people is, you know, lessons learned, and, you know, just if you're not careful, it can happen to you no matter how small or large you are. I mean, a communications plan is definitely key to that, and having some type of a plan ready that in the event that, you know, you have a flight attendant that goes AWOL, you have something ready. You know, you have a social media strategy ready, you know, what you're going to tweet, you know, who you're going to talk to blogger-wise, reporter-wise, how you're going to communicate with, you know, your Facebook followers. I mean, everything has to be blended now. And, you know, can't forget LinkedIn because, you know, it's a heavily populated professional site as well. I mean, nobody has to participate in, you know, talking to the public. You don't have to. But if you're not, you know, then they're going to do it without you. And I think that's a strong message for public relations professionals is, you know, whether it's positive or negative press, you have to do what you can to control, you know, what's being said.
Sure.
I don't know. That's hard because, you know, I've worked with companies before where they've hired a PR firm and they still don't understand the value of public relations. You know, it's a constant battle for public relations professionals and communication, you know, departments is measuring what they're worth and showing the importance of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think most of us spend our lives, when you're in public relations, trying to teach public relations to business people, because they, although it is probably one of the most cost-effective ways to influence an audience, people still like what they can see and touch. And you can touch a four-color print ad. You can see it. You can point to it. But as to whether it actually does any good or not, well, that's a whole other issue.
Absolutely, Rob. Yeah, I was having this conversation with a business development person from a pretty big corporation. They're a public contractor, or I guess public sector contractor to the FAA. And we were talking about this. And, you know, she's pretty well versed in what goes on. And she does a little marketing for her company, too. And we were, you know, talking about, you know, about aviation PR. And I don't think she understood what PR was. I mean, her understanding of what public relations was, you know, buying marketing space and banners to put on websites and stuff like that. And I had to educate her a little and just tell her, you know, that's not what public relations is. That's more marketing. And so that's the pang of our existence, Mark, is just helping define public relations.
You know. Ashley, I have a question for you.
Sure.
What kind of techniques do you use to change the mentality from a reactive company to a proactive company? JetBlue and Southwest are very proactive. They're engaging their customers. A lot of the other ones are reactive, but that seems to be the common thread. I know that I work for a company that is extremely reactive. They don't have a proactive bone in their body. So how do you change that corporate mentality?
When I worked with Microsoft Public Sector, I mean, they have a great team of public relations professionals over there, and really a lot can be learned about public relations just from Microsoft Public Sector. And that was one of the things that we were always talking about, is how do we become more proactive versus retroactive? You know, how are we helping to develop the messaging that we want to push this quarter or this year? And what it all came down to, I mean, you know, quarter after quarter, was developing our strategy, you know, outlining who your target audience is for that month, and kind of scripting out what your messaging is. And so, you know, we would spend, I mean, they would have an entire day of strategizing, and then you know, we would spend maybe a week or so just developing some trends that we saw on the outlook and how we were going to respond to those trends. When the president was coming into office, that was one of the, with the new administration, the new changeover, what's going to be important to the public sector. And so that was something that, you know, we just did a lot of strategizing over. And I think that's what companies have to do to become proactive versus retroactive, is just strategize and be aware of what trends you do see coming. I mean, you can't script out everything, you know, you can't foresee everything, but you know, there's certain things that's always going to happen. Like, you know, the fiscal year is always going to end for the government at the end of September. So, you know, you know that they're going to buy a lot of their technology before the end of that cycle's up. And, you know, so of course that accounts for the FAA and National Weather Service and Department of Commerce, you know, the sectors that are going to affect aviation. And that's something that, you know, people just have to keep in mind.
Why don't we play a few quick rounds of word association? Ashley, I think you're probably familiar with this.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. Why don't we start with Rob? Rob, have you got a word for Ashley just to spark a little conversation?
Spontaneity.
Twitter.
Okay, good.
Yeah, Twitter is definitely spontaneous. You never know what is going to be trending on Twitter. And you never know how you're going to have to react quickly to it, you know. Exciting. Maybe that's another one I would say for spontaneity. You know, it keeps you on your toes, keeps things exciting.
All right, David, do you have a word for Ashley?
Sure. One of my beloved favorite words in the office, metric.
Ah, good.
Metrics. Necessary. I mean, measuring everything you do is important. So, you know, that's how we all justify what we do, metrics.
Yeah, and particularly for a company that's looking at or considering or evaluating its participation in social media venues and the resources that takes. Ashley, as you mentioned before, metrics are kind of tough in that regard. I mean, it's easy to, I guess, relatively easy to see what it costs the company, but to measure the effect or the value that the company receives as a result of that, that's pretty hard.
It is difficult. What a lot of companies do is tally up at the end of the week or the end of the month what kind of coverage people or what kind of coverage your company got. And, you know, was that positive or negative? How many viewers read that blog? How many, you know, how many listeners were on that podcast? What's the readership of that magazine? And I mean, that's what they go off of. For measurement. And I know that that's something that a lot of big PR firms are always working with. So Merit Group, they have a whole department dedicated, you know, to metrics and measuring PR and what it's worth. And I know Ogilvy and, you know, just a lot of the big Hill and Knowlton, you know, that's something that everyone wants to find, you know, the next big tool to use for metrics and measurement. Yeah. You know, if we could figure that out, that's like the gold mine.
That's right. There's the business to be in. Yeah.
See, exactly. And I always thought that those measurement organizations were there for the PR people because they still need ways to prove that they're actually effective.
Mm-hmm.
And I you know, so it's a chicken and an egg thing to me.
Yeah,
but
yeah. Okay, Dan, do you have a word for Ashley?
Date. Oh, no, sorry, that's it.
Wow, thank you. Thank you for that.
Wow, I'm kind of shocked by the answer.
Yeah, so am I, actually.
You know what?
But I'm available for a drink at a conference.
You know what? Because you did that, Ashley, my word, Rob Mark.
Ooh.
So do you guys know that I actually know Rob Mark?
Yeah, no, we didn't know that.
Yeah, when I supported the airports committee at NATA, I was their manager of government industry affairs. Rob was on the airports committee and I don't know if he remembers, but you know, I would call the guys on my airports committee and girls every once in a while and just kind of catch up and see what's going on with them, what's going on with the industry. And Rob was one of the guys that I would call every once in a while. and so
I do remember that.
We had a few chats about, you know, communication and PR in aviation. And you
chose that field.
Ashley, my word, this is pretty open-ended. Success.
Interesting. So I have so many answers for success because, for aviation PR, I mean, obviously making a good living at it's important to us, but I also just want to help the industry, I think. Is this the Miss America answer?
Yeah. No. This is a tough one because it is so open-ended, but either success for you personally or for your business or for your clients, you know, kind of pick one.
So I want aviation PR to be successful just because, you know, I've always dreamed of doing aviation PR, you know, once I found out I wasn't going to be an engineer. So ever since then, I realized that I wanted to do aviation PR. I wanted to work with people. I wanted to, get the name of a company out there. I wanted to help them reach their audience, reach their public. And so I think success for me would be, you know, finding a few great clients or, you know, retaining my few great clients and, just making sure they're successful. I like fires, so helping to put out fires and reducing the amount of fires if possible.
Right.
Yeah, I think that would be success for me. You know, enjoy what I do at the end of the day.
Sure. All right, that's great. So, Ashley, tell our listeners where they can find the Aviation PR Group online, where they can follow you.
We are at aviationpr.org, and we are also on Twitter as Aviation PR Group. And you can find our page on LinkedIn at Aviation PR Group. And then we also have a Facebook page. All of this is still under development, of course. Websites are a living, breathing thing. So,
Sure.
But yeah, so you can find us at Aviation PR or aviationpr.org. And right. Thank you guys so much for your time. I really enjoyed speaking with you guys today. And Rob, for getting a chance to connect with you again.
Yeah, that was nice, actually. We'll have to make sure that we connect up again.
Yeah.
I'll find you on Facebook.
There you go. We'll be Facebook friends.
Great.
Yes.
All right. Thanks again, Ashley.
Thank you, guys.
Real pleasure to have you. And look forward to talking to you again sometime in the future.
Definitely. Have a good night, guys.
All right. And now with This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 2, Episode 25, August 15th through the 21st. August 15th, 1944, a B-17G of the 303rd Bomb Group, 8th Air Force, is shot down by Feldwebel Hubert Lennartz. What makes Lennartz's shoot down different? It is done with an ME-262A1 Schwab. Verknummern 170063, Weiss 9 or White 9. Lennartz went on to add 7 more kills in the 262, a total of 13 for his career in the war. He had 5 previously flying BF-109s. Lennartz was part of Erprobungskommando 262 at Reichlin-Lars. The squadron was charged with developing the new tactics on the how to fight the then new aircraft, the ME-262. It was the first first bomber ever shot down by a jet fighter. One day later, August 16th, 1944, Lieutenant Hartmut Ryle shoots down another B-17G with even more radical aircraft, the ME-163B Comet. The 163B-1 rocket-propelled fighter, White 11, Verknummern 163-100, the Comet was a tailless fighter that was propelled by mixing of T-stoff and C-stoff, both highly volatile liquid fuels. The ME-163 would take off, dropping its landing gear upon takeoff. The pilot would climb to above the enemy bomber stream and dive into it. It might get as many as two passes before it would run out of fuel. At that point, the pilot would have to fly the powerless aircraft back to the base, much like the space shuttle. However, the aircraft would land on a skid in a controlled crash landing. August 16, 1969, the F-8F2 Bearcat Conquest 1 would break the then 30-year-old record for piston-engined aircraft. The record was set in 1939 by an ME-209. Darrell Greenemeyer takes Conquest 1 to 770 kilometers per hour, or 463 miles an hour. The Conquest 1 would go on to win several Reno air races until Greenemeyer donated the aircraft to the Smithsonian. She can be found in the Boeing hangar of the Udvar-Hazy Museum. The Conquest 1 is no ordinary Bearcat. It has a microscopic bubble canopy, an uprated R2800 engine driving a Douglas A1H paddle-bladed propeller with a P-51D spinner. What makes the Bearcat such an excellent racing aircraft is Grumman's design philosophy for making the aircraft. The Bearcat was to be a point interceptor. Grumman took the biggest engine at the time, the R2800, then built the tiniest airframe around it. It is why Conquest 1 and then later Rare Bear have come to dominate Reno. August 17, 1978, Double Eagle 2 makes the first balloon crossing of the Atlantic Ocean. Piloted by Ben Abruzio, Axie Anderson, and Larry Newman, the flight lasted 137 hours and 6 minutes, or 5.7 days. The flight landed near Paris, France, after departing Presque Isle, Maine, United States. The reward for the successful flight to Paris was a flight on the Concorde back to New York, compliments of Air France. The Double Eagle 2's gondola is now at the Udvar-Hazy Center at Dulles, and the flight back home on the Concorde took 3.5 hours. And because this was such a big fanfare last year, I'll do it again this year. August 20th, 1940, the British Prime Minister Winston Churchill delivers his few speech during the heart of the Battle of Britain to the House of Commons. So I won't do the whole speech. However, I will do the never in the fields of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. First flights, the North American NA-40 or the B-5-25 Mitchell, August 19, 1940, and the Grumman F-8F Bearcat, August 21st, 1944. And that's the way it was.
That's interesting. David, on the Comet, I guess I maybe had forgotten or never knew that that airplane had gone operational to that degree.
There was three or four different squadrons flying it operationally at the end of the war, from 44 to the end of the war in 45. It wasn't what I would call a successful operational aircraft. It was called the Powered Egg or the supersonic flea, and they tended to blow up on the tarmac when they were mixing the two fuels inside the fuselage. It was highly flammable, and it was not necessarily the success that Wiley Messerschmitt would wanted it to have been.
Okay. Thanks, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, August 14th, 2010.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 110 of the Airplane Geek Show. Grant, it doesn't seem all that long since we were doing the episode 100.
I think I'm still recovering from the hangover, you know?
Oh, I see, Grant. So all of the having the flu and all these other aches and pains you've been complaining of the last few weeks, it's actually nothing to do with what people might expect. It's actually self-induced.
Yeah, well, you know, when you drink and go on a bender down in Australia, you do it properly, mate. But, I better sober up because we're going to have to watch out for that police action are talking about now.
Yeah. I suppose we'll have to send Maxie's boat back now.
Yeah, well, although then again, knowing these guys, if it's a police action, maybe it's going to be more like Police Academy.
Yeah, well, the village people, you never know.
Oh, don't go there.
Anyway, whilst I'm not contemplating that, Grant, let's contemplate this. Our good friends at Qantas, well, they've been making some money.
Yeah, just a tad. They did actually manage to make a profit in the last financial year. Here in Australia, our financial years run from July 1st to June 30th, and Qantas have just released their results for the previous financial year, and they are showing that they have made a profit. It's not as big as the year before, and they're making a lot of big noise about how cool it is, and this is great, we're doing really well, and Unfortunately, once you peel back the wrappers, you discover that the reason they're doing quite well is that approximately 70% of their profit was due to their frequent flyer program. Basically, by selling out access to frequent flyers, they've made about 70% of their profit. The remaining profit that came from their flying, such as freight and Jetstar and Qantas mainline, international, domestic, etc., of that, the bulk of the profit on all their flying was mostly in the first half of the year. The last half of the year plummeted. The profit was quite drastically low. So when Virgin Blue turned around a month or two ago and said, hey, we're dropping our profit forecast because of a softening in the market, and Qantas was running around going, no, no, it's all fine, not a problem here. Quite clearly, they too have been impacted by the softening in the market and Tiger prowling down around the bottom end of the market as well.
Yeah, on a positive side though, Grant, just looking at this, it's interesting to see how they've really had to diversify to broaden their revenue base. Listeners would be, you know, be probably sick of us banging on these days about how Qantas mainline seems to be dying with all this new world carriers and concepts coming along, even from within their own group. So it's interesting, and I actually think positive that they're looking at other revenue streams in order to keep the airline afloat. I think it's a good thing.
Oh no, definitely kudos to them for making a profit at all. Kudos to them for grabbing opportunities and finding new ways of making money. But it's not as good as a lot of the spin coming out during their presentation. It's not as good as some of the reporters are saying. It's good, but there's indications that it's going to be a very interesting financial year coming up. And I think that a big indication of that is the fact that they've given no dividend to shareholders. They're not paying out money to their shareholders. So I think they're going to be hanging on to that capital and getting ready for a bit more of a storm before it's clear.
Yeah, so as it is with all company spin, that all seems like a bit of a diversion when they're spinning it up one way and making it sound all rosy, when in fact, if they're not paying out any dividends to their shareholders, then that really is a bit of spin. But speaking of Qantas aircraft that are spinning around and perhaps going in a different direction, one of their 380s, Grant, this week has made a first.
That's right. For the first time ever, an A380 has landed in Noumea. There was a Qantas A380 on its way into the east coast of Australia coming from the US when, due to weather, they had to divert. There was fog in Sydney, there was bad weather in Melbourne, and Brisbane wasn't having much luck with good weather either. So the crew were faced with the extreme likelihood that they would be trying to hold for an unknown time on rapidly running out fuel. So they diverted to Noumea. And interesting to know that airport can actually handle an A380.
Yeah, well, it's actually been set up there as a diversion point for the A380s as part of the programs that a lot of airports around the world have been undergoing so that they can take this very large aircraft on. So I'm sure that the people in Noumea would have been quite chuffed to have seen that aircraft touch down on their soil.
Yeah, no, definitely. I'd say it'd be quite a crowd gatherer. But a big crowd that did gather was all the passengers, because the crew had maxed out their time. They weren't able to wait out for the weather to clear, so everyone had to deplane and wait for a 747 to come and pick them up.
In Noumea, how awful for them.
Yes, I know. Pacific Island.
Terrible. Terrible. Yeah, they really would have been in a hurry to get back here to wintry Melbourne.
Yeah, totally.
Well, Grant, let's stick on the subject of Qantas. Now, Gavin Webeloff in the last episode of the Airplane Geeks was asking us, or actually gave us a bit of homework, Grant, and he wanted us to check out the situation with Qantas flight attendants and how they go about crewing their aircraft. So we've done a bit of research. The results are in, Grant. What did we find out?
Oh, yes, we found out a doozy. And this was done back in 2007 or so. Basically, Qantas had not been recruiting any long-haul cabin crew for a while. They'd actually laid off 1,500. They had about 3,000 cabin crew left, and they'd seen the success of Jetstar and their ability to cut costs by having crew on quite reduced rates and benefits and so on, and they wanted to do the same with Qantas mainline. Naturally, the union said, no, this is not on, so Qantas turned around and said, well, we'll get rid of a lot of you, and it was quite clear that Qantas were working to set up bases in the UK and Singapore and other places. The writing was on the wall, so the union took the step of sacrificing benefits for their future members to ensure that their current members had a good deal. So the union negotiated with Qantas and organized pay rises, better conditions and better benefits for existing cabin crew, while saying that for any new cabin crew that would be hired by Qantas Cabin Crew Australia, they would be on reduced rates and have fewer benefits. So where an original, what we might call the old guard cabin crew, are pulling pulling in $80,000. The new cabin crew can only be pulling in $50,000 for equivalent kind of workload. And of course, the old guard all have seniority, so they get to pick the best routes and the best trips and packages and so on. And everyone from Qantas Cabin Crew Australia get to pick the rest. So that's what Qantas did. It's the way they're doing everything now. We're seeing this with pilots. They're currently doing negotiations for a new contract with the pilots. They've tried doing it with the flight engineers. They're trying to do it with ground support staff. All new contracts, all new structures, and the unions are basically saying, yes, okay, we'll just have to do it because there's nowhere else they can go.
Yeah, I think it comes to a point too, Grant, where you know these unions over the last 10 or 15 years have been forced into a position of trade-offs, pay increases for efficiencies and all this sort of stuff. And I guess it comes to a point where there's nothing left to trade off. And that's when the companies can really, really sink the teeth in there and, you know, really, really get nasty, really play hardball if that's what they want to do. And, you know, you can look at it here and say, well, it was really short-term thinking on the part of their union, perhaps. But then really, they probably didn't have any other choice, is the way I would read that. So the best outcome they could have there is to look after the members they have now. Unfortunately, as more and more new hires come on the new contracts, it makes the you know, the more senior cabin crew less attractive to remain in the employ of Qantas. And the next time some enterprise bargaining agreements come along, I can see that Qantas is really going to play hardball on that issue.
That's probably coming up in another year or so. Qantas Cabin Crew Australia was supposed to be a 3-year operation or thereabouts, so it's pretty much reaching that point at the moment. So it'll be very interesting to see where it goes pretty soon.
Yep, so there you go, Gavin. I hope that's helped you out in some way, and I know I learned a little bit about that. I wasn't actually up on that myself. So we've all learned something from that homework, and now my brain hurts. Anyway, just before we finish off this week, folks, we've got a special treat for you. Just before we started recording here, we knocked off another wonderful interview with the Red Bull Air Race 2008 world champion, Hannes Arc. He joined us on the line from Austria. So we're just going to play for you a little bit of a snippet here. We started off in this section of the interview by asking him what it was like flying in front of a home crowd there in Germany, and finished off by getting his impressions of flying in New York. And how was it virtually in front of a home crowd, I guess, being there in that part of the world, Hannes? Did that help to focus your mind a bit?
Absolutely. I mean, the motivation was, again, quite down, you know, at the beginning of the race, not just us, like all the teams, everybody, because also the announcement that the race doesn't go on in 2011. So it was really hard to motivate. And then I said to myself, and I briefed my team and said, look, guys, that's what we owe to ourselves, you know, because we are racing guys. We love the race, you know, we love what we do. So we stick to the air race, and we do it till the last race. And that's what we did. Also, we owed it to our fans, you know, and that was cool because somehow it was the last race for a long time, you know, last race of the season. I could show that I'm really a fast pilot, that I've been basically the fastest pilot this season. It was at home. Lots of fans had been there. So it was a very, very emotional race. And for me, personally, very, very motivating. Take that motivation with me to keep on fighting for the air race. And hopefully it comes back.
Well, with the season that's just been, which track was your favorite this year?
That's a good question. I think Perth was a very difficult one from the tactics point of view, a combination of tactics and trying to find the right line. Rio de Janeiro, I liked Rio very much. It was a very smooth track. It was not like an action-packed track. It was, you had to fly very fine, very much to find the detail to take on your energy. But most, I think, I loved Windsor. Also, I nearly crashed, but Windsor was... was a cool track, you know. I knew it from the year before, and yeah, I just loved winter. I mean, that was action, you know, but I love it. Yeah,
yeah.
I think winter was my most favorite track.
How did you find New York as a first time to go there?
Yeah, New York was interesting. New York for me, especially for me as an Austrian, you know, because I never have been in New York, and then as an Austrian growing up in a small place, mountains, landscape, nature around, and then you're down there, and the first time you approach the track, you face the skyline of Manhattan and this big town just in front of you, you know, with all the history and all that emotions involved there, you know. So that was quite cool to approach there. And I had the problems to focus when I approached the first training. But I mean, once in the track is the same than any other track. And New York, we all have been afraid that the track is too tight, but it was not. It was also a nice track to fly, except that I clipped the pylon.
That one little detail.
Yeah, exactly.
So there you go, folks. Another wonderful interview with Hannes Arkner. I haven't started editing that one yet, but we would anticipate that one being released on Playing Crazy Down Under somewhere within the next month or so. So you'll just have to keep listening and looking at our website, and we'll keep you up to date on that one. Yeah, great stuff. Really happy that these pilots, these Red Bull Air Race pilots, Grant, they're so willing to come on and share so many highly technical details with us, and it's just a wonderful thing. A shame the race is not coming back next year, but we remain hopeful that it will be back in 2012.
Oh, fingers crossed, mate.
Yeah, otherwise, who else are we going to interview on Playing Crazy Down Under? We'll have to interview Rob Mark.
Oh, no, Steve, don't let us go to that level.
Yes, we've had him on the show once before. That's enough. We'll let him on once a year.
Careful, that means it's coming up for his next repeat appearance.
Yeah, well, we better go before he kicks us off, folks. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
All right, thanks to Steve and Grant. You know, those guys have done some great podcasts concerning the Red Bull Air Race, and with quite a few interviews with Matt Hall and some of the others. So it's if you're at all interested in air racing or think it's a topic that you're not that knowledgeable about and want to learn more about that, that's a great place to go and do that. Listen to the Playing Crazy Down Under podcast.
But wait, there's more.
Okay.
Just to scoop these guys for next week. Actually, we have, I guess, sort of breaking, except it's now 2 hours old news. Pacific Blue is now pulling out of domestic New Zealand services. Interestingly
yeah.
enough, I'm not sure if Stephen Grove would agree, but I have to think that has something to do with Jetstar starting up services within New Zealand a little over a year ago now, and I'm guessing just financially, the market just wasn't performing that well, so Virgin's pulling out. With domestic New Zealand, they're boosting Trans-Tasman a little bit, and they are hoping to get their alliance with Air New Zealand approved. Also, the Australia, their long-haul airline, cutting Fiji, that's going to be served with Pacific Blue 737s now. And as a result, via Australia, they're retiming Sydney-Los Angeles to have better U.S. connections. Sydney-Los Angeles is going from six weekly to daily. Melbourne-Los Angeles is going from two-weekly to three-weekly, and Melbourne to Johannesburg and Phuket. I don't know if that's the right way to say it. Also getting an additional weekly frequency.
All right. That's like Dan's mini South Pacific report. One other thing I wanted to mention before we go is that the Potapalooza 2010 from the EAA Air Venture in Oshkosh is out. You can find those recordings on a number of different aviation podcast sites. Our own Rob Mark participated in that. It's basically a forum where many of the aviation podcasters who were at Air Venture assembled and put together a kind of a two-hour show. You can find that, for example, pilotsjourneypodcast.com. Another one is milehighflyers.com. And also studentpilotcast.com. All right, that's it for this episode. We'd really like to thank our guest, Ashley Moore. She's the president of Aviation PR Group. You can find her website at www.aviationpr.org. As always, we'd like to thank Steve and Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast for their Australia Desk report. And let's tell our listeners where they can find us online. David, where can people find you?
They can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com or on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof.
And Rob, how about you?
Well, they can certainly find me at jetwine.com, the blog. It's where Scott Spangler and I hang out. And also jetwine on Twitter. But let's not forget to say goodbye to Harriet. We almost forgot to say thank you to Harriet.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks, Harriet, for coming on. Fascinating yeah. woman doing a lot of interesting things.
I want to hear when she jumps out of an airplane. See, I'm thinking, Harriet, I have you pegged as a lady that's going to jump out of an airplane with a parachute, of course.
I could see that happening. All right, and Dan Webb, how can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage. You can find my blog at thingsinthesky.com.
All right, I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com or on Twitter at Max Flight. Be sure to see airplanegeeks.com for show notes, listener comments. You can follow us on Twitter at airplanegeeks. Send us email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. We also have a Facebook page. You can see us there. And what we really like to get is voicemail from our listeners. And I think Benay Wilson can tell us what that number is.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Benay. Join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night.
See Thanks you for later.
Listening. Thanks for listening.
Okay,
but you're not 4 hours behind.
You're only three.
I know. I'm only 3 hours. My daughter says I exaggerate anyway. So
there you have it.
And Max, I know you said this recording had to be crisp, but I like to point out that why does David get the fan title? I'm historian in residence. Whereas me and Rob, what are we? Are we just
you're just plain old ordinary
voices that can easily be replaced? I mean, honestly, here.
Honestly, you really want me to say?
You know, Dan, be careful when you ask the question. You might get an answer you don't want to hear.
That's right. That's right.
speaking of hair, I'm sorry. Rob, I was on your Kamavia site the other day,
and
your official head size, what an abundance of curls you have from that picture.
It's an old photo. Okay. Thank you.
Rob doesn't really have that much hair anymore.
Hey.
I think
Just everyone.
Right, here we go.
I knew I wasn't going to let that one go.
But I like
go,
the point.
Go ahead, Dan.
You are old, but
we respect you.
Deep down, you're very youthful and energetic. I think the only way to describe you, Rob Mark, is that you are the Betty White of the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Okay, I'll remember that.
All right, let's see. Why don't we start with Rob? Rob, have you got a word for Ashley just to spark a little conversation?
No, actually, I don't. I'm completely unprepared for this one. So give me, why don't you fix this in the editing and come back to me and I'll think of something.
Okay. All right, David or Dan?
Oh, wait, I got one.
Okay.
Spontaneity.
You think you can make something out of that?
I'll do that without a squeaky chair. Cheers, folks. Yeah, I think I can make something out of that.
Oh, good. Because I'm stuffed.
Ashley, before you go, I just want to float an idea out to you.
Sure.
How do you think Rob would look with a mustache? And also, Rob forgot to mention, but these days you do need to be at least 18 to view jetwine.com. There's some bad stuff going on there.
there is? Okay, well,
we're going to have to check that out.
Thank you for that, Dan. I don't know where that one, you know, that's the nice thing about Dan. He always manages to pull some interesting things out of his hat.
Somewhere.
Rob, when metrics suddenly go up this week from the website, you'll know where it came from.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm going there now.